Hare Krishna Day feast. So Nandalal Babu is a mechanical engineer by qualification, and just panting. And he is a. I just came running from there. He's a mechanical engineer by qualification, and his main service is as a BTG editor. He's an associate editor for the Back to Godhead magazine. And he is also a very very powerful youth preacher. He preaches in the KEM Medical College, where he guides many medical students on the path of Krishna consciousness. So today he is going to speak on the topic of Buddha Purnima, the appearance of Lord Buddha. And he will discuss how the activities of Buddha and the philosophy of Buddha. So let us welcome him by loudly chanting three times. Hari Bol.
So before beginning, I'd like to offer my prayers to the acharyas. Om Ajnanatimirandhasya Jnananjana Shalakaya Chakshurun Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhishtam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupaha Kadamayam Dadati Swapadantikam Vandeham Shri Guru Shri Yuta Padakamalam Shri Gurun Vaishnavamscha Shri Rupam Sagrajatam Sahagana Raghunathan Vitam Tam Sajivam Sadvaitam Savadhutam Parijana Sahitam Krishna Chaitanya Devam Shri Radha Krishna Padan Sahagana Lalita Shri Vishakhan Vitamscha He Krishna Karuna Sindho Nibandho Jagatpate Gopesha Gopika Kanta Radha Kanta Namostute Tapta Kanchana Gaurangi Radhe Vrinda Vaneshwari Vrishabhanu Sute Devi Pranamami Hari Priye Vansha Kalpataru Bhyascha Kripa Sindhu Bhyayevacha Patitanam Pavane Bhyo Vaishnave Bhyo Namo Namaha Nama Om Vishnu Padaya Krishna Prishthaya Bhutale Shrimate Bhakti Vedanta Min Iti Namine Namaste Sarasvate Deve Gauravani Pracharine Nirvishesha Shunyavadi Paschatya Deshatarine Jai Shri Krishna Chaitanya Prabhu Nityananda Shri Advaita Gadadhar Shrivasadi Gaura Bhakta Brinda Hare Krishna Hare Krishna 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 Hare 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 Rama Hare Rama 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 Hare 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 Krishna. So we welcome all the devotees, guests, visitors to the Sunday feast program. Before beginning, I'd like to seek the blessings of all the assembled devotees here. Also the well wishes of the guests. There are many senior devotees sitting here, so I'd like to seek their blessings. So we have started a series some time back, in which we are discussing the 10 primary incarnations, the most famous incarnations of Lord Krishna. And today we'll discuss the ninth incarnation in this series, which is Lord Buddha. So, to understand the lives of great souls, or to understand even the lives and the personal pastimes of the Supreme Lord, is not very easy. In one of the shlokas in Chaitanya Charitamrita, Srila Rupa Goswami, when he's trying to understand Lord Chaitanya, he says, actually I'm like a dwarf and you are like the moon. Is there any chance that if the dwarf tries to reach the moon, is it possible? Not possible. Similarly, when we are trying to understand the lives of personalities that are mentioned in the scriptures, especially the incarnations of the Supreme Lord, it's very important for us to understand that we are something like those dwarfs, maybe less than a dwarf. And we are trying to study the exalted character and the exalted activities of somebody who's far beyond. So, in my attempts to do this, as a service to all of you, I'll first establish some kind of a background for the appearance of the Lord. And then we'll understand who is Lord Buddha, and then we'll have some discussion on, as Gaudiya Vaishnavas, I am myself a Gaudiya Vaishnav, and many of you are Gaudiya Vaishnavas. So, is there something for us to learn? Is there something relevant within Lord Buddha's teachings and Lord Buddha's life for you and me also? Or is it just that he is a person who propagated a different philosophy? The other incarnations, the other nine incarnations, other than Lord Buddha in the Dashavatar, their teachings are on the same lines. They accepted the authority of the Vedas. They spoke on the basis of the Vedas. Their teachings, they're described in the Vedas, but Lord Buddha's life is not much described in the Vedas. Especially for Gaudiya Vaishnavas, we give more credence to Srimad Bhagavad Gita and Bhagavat Puran, Srimad Bhagavatam. So in Srimad Bhagavatam also, there's not much to be found about his personal life. So is it that we just treat Lord Buddha as somebody who preached something else, or there's something for you and me to learn also? That also we'll see. So these are the three rough sections of today's presentation, and we'd like to see how we go forward. So in the Gita, Lord Krishna says, Vedescha sarvair aham eva vedyo. He says, by all the Vedas, by study of all the Vedas, I am to be known. Now it's very natural that when you know somebody properly, and especially a person like Lord Krishna who is very attractive, just knowing him will not be sufficient. When you know somebody who is very attractive, when you know somebody who is very exalted, you want to deepen your relationship with that person. So we can understand that the principles in the Vedas, the different proscriptions, the different prescriptions, do's and don'ts in the Vedas, they have a certain purpose. It's not just a mere compilation of rules and regulations. The purpose being to understand Lord Krishna and to approach him and then serve him. However, if this purpose is being thwarted, if this purpose is not being accomplished, a follower of the Vedic culture, if he is not going in the right direction, then what is to be done? This is a scenario which occurred in the world some years after the start of the present age, Kali Yuga. Many times our temple organizes a yatra to holy places. Yes, so there's one yatra in which everyone participates, and also individual preachers take out their individual yatras. So let's discuss a situation where one preacher, he organizes a yatra to Vrindavan, and there's a group going with him to Vrindavan. They get into the train, they make all the arrangements, all the tickets are booked, prasadam is arranged and everything is there. And when the journey starts, they reach a particular point in between. So let's say Ratlam. Yeah. So from here to Mathura, when you go, there's a station called Ratlam. And while traveling, one of the people who's in this yatra, he gets down for some water or something. He wants to drink water, he's out of water, he gets down at the station.
And as he's searching for water in the railway station, he finds there is something else also which attracts his attention. So he stops for a while. He says, oh, in addition to water, there's something else also, maybe some lime juice or something like that. Then as he is doing that, one of his friends is observing that he just went for a quick thing. He just went to take water and come back. He was supposed to come back. The train is about to leave. And he's not yet coming back. So this person also tries to search for him. But when he tries to search for him, he locates him. And he asks him, so what are you doing here? We are supposed to be in the train. We are on our way to Vrindavan. But he says, no, did you see this? This is very wonderful lime juice and I'm so thirsty after the journey that I would like to enjoy this lime juice. Would you also want? And he says, yeah, well, you know, lime juice is harmful, harmless. So he also takes that lime juice. In this way, if a situation arises that many people from that yatra, they gradually get down, it could be with a good motive to find their lost friends, missing friends. But then, if they themselves don't come back, the preacher is going to be in great anxiety. Yeah? He's going to think, where are all those people? We are supposed to go to Vrindavan. What happened to them? And he might get down and try to locate these people. And when he sees that they are engaging in something as petty as drinking lime juice, which he can himself arrange at some other station and in a proper way, offering and all that is done in a pure way, to get those people right back on the train, he might have to do something which is drastic. If he tells them, my dear devotees, you want lime juice, but then I can supply you lime juice. Yeah, I have already called up somebody and in the next station we have lime. Something like that, if he tries to do, they will say, oh, we don't know what will happen next at the next station. We are thirsty right now. So right now we want lime juice. Something like that. He might have to do something drastic as in, did you see that? That lime juice is contaminated. I just saw something, you know, that person putting something in that lime juice, it's not good for something like that. He might have to speak a lie. Because the train is about to leave and there are a lot more important things waiting for them in Vrindavan. Similarly, this is just a sample scenario. At a certain period, after the start of Kali Yuga, the followers of the Vedic culture, especially the leaders, so in Vedic culture, the four ashramas and the four varnas, of the four varnas, the leaders are the sannyasis, and for the four ashramas, the leaders are the brahmanas. So the brahmanas especially, who are supposed to guide people and who are supposed to teach people about the purpose of life, and they would be somebody to whom everyone will look up to for instructions, they became corrupt. That is the age of Kali. You can't escape the age of Kali very easily. It's very difficult. So, one of the things that is a foundational part of Vedic culture is the concept of sacrifice, is the concept of yajna. Even in the Gita, third chapter, Krishna says, yajnyarthat karmano anyatra lokoyam karma bandhana. That if a living entity does not engage in the sacrifice, for whom? For Lord Vishnu. Then there is going to be karma bandhan, there is going to be bondage. One gets caught up in the cycle of birth and death. It's not just a ritual, but the element of Lord Vishnu there, the touch of Lord Vishnu there, which is the saving grace of you and me when we engage in sacrifice. The ritual is like an external packaging. However, in any Vedic sacrifice, it starts with the names of Lord Vishnu. At least it will start with the word Om, which is Pranavaham Vedeshu. It's not different from Krishna. Now, in this concept of sacrifice, definitely the things that are to be offered to Lord Vishnu must be very pure. Lord Vishnu himself is very pure, so if you want to offer something to Lord Vishnu, it has to be pure. How can something impure be ever offered to Lord Vishnu? But we see in the Vedic texts, we see some mention of animal sacrifices. So to understand this, we also have to go a little bit into the background that Vedic culture is a culture for everyone. Nobody is barred from practicing Vedic culture. Understanding the very nature of a conditioned living entity in the material world, that there will be some people who will have desires that are not exactly pure. There will be people who will be attracted to the pleasures of eating flesh. So the Vedic culture, in trying to attract them, includes some mentions of sacrifices in which animals may be offered, but these animals are not any animals, the lower animals like goats and like that. However, this is just like an allowance, this is like a concession given to some people who will find it very difficult to resist these temptations, who will find it very difficult to subsist only on grains. What happened is, at this particular time, around, from, let's say, around 2000 years later, 2000 years after the beginning of Kali Yuga, the Brahmanas who became corrupt, they took these allowances, these concessions in the Vedic scriptures for animal killing to be some kind of a recommendation. Now, there's a difference between an allowance and a recommendation. Recommendation comes from the person who's giving the recommendation, but allowance is primarily motivated by the person who's seeking the permission. So they started exploiting these allowances in the Vedic scriptures and started conducting slaughtering of animals on a mass scale. As a result of that, the masses themselves who did not have access to Vedic scriptures thought that if the Brahmanas are doing this, then this is good. This is probably allowed. So all the desires that I had for eating meat, it seems, are bona fide desires. Now that the Brahmanas themselves are allowing that. So it was a very difficult situation. How could you solve a situation where the leaders themselves are corrupt? So this was an emergency situation, and this called for emergency measures. The Supreme Lord, who is himself the origin of the Vedas, took upon himself this task of rectifying this emergency situation. And that is why he appeared in the form of the Veda, in the form of Lord Buddha. And in the form of Lord Buddha, in order to stop this rampant killing of animals in the name of Vedic sacrifices, he denied the very Vedas. He denied the authority of the Vedas. What are you doing? He says, I am indulging in these animal sacrifices. Where are these animal sacrifices mentioned? In the Vedas. If the Vedas mention these animal sacrifices, I deny the authority of the Vedas. Now we know that the Supreme Lord is the greatest in everything. Is it not? He is, as far as opulence goes, he is the most opulent. As far as beauty goes, he is the most beautiful. Now, as far as intelligence goes, he is also the most intelligent. So when the Supreme Lord decides to preach something which is apparently against the Vedas, who can stop him? It is the Supreme Lord who is speaking against the Vedas, but for an emergency measure. So in his expertise and in his excellence in denying the Vedas, he fought tough philosophical battles with the Vedic leaders at that times and established his doctrine of Buddhism. And we'll see in the coming time what exactly this is. So it was an emergency, so he had to do it. In this way, by establishing non-violence, which was kind of a diversion from the original purpose of the Vedas, Lord Buddha did something that was important for that time. He preached the preliminary principles of the Vedas in a manner suitable for that time. These principles that are there, they are there on a preliminary level in the Vedas, but the Vedas talk about something else also. However, Lord Buddha stressed on that. This concept of no animal killing is not something that even Lord Buddha himself originated. Even in the Srimad Bhagavatam, in the fourth canto, there is a story of Narad Muni instructing King Prachina Barheshat. So this King Prachina Barheshat is mentioned as somebody who was very thickly engaged in Karma Kanda sacrifices. Karma Kanda is that portion of the Vedas in which you do something to get something in return. Fruitive activities. So in one shloka, where King Prachini Barheshat requests Narad Muni that, I can understand there's something more to life, but can you please guide me? And the first time Narad Muni is speaking to King Prachina Barheshat, he says, this is the English translation. Narad Muni speaks to King Prachina Barheshat in Srimad Bhagavatam 4.25.7 and 8. The great saint Narad said, O ruler of the citizens, my dear king, please see in the sky those animals which you have sacrificed without compassion and without mercy in the sacrificial arena. All these animals are awaiting your death so that they can avenge the injuries you have inflicted upon them. After you die, they will angrily pierce your body with iron horns. So Narad Muni, by his teja, he showed actually a small vision to King Prachini Barhishad that all those animals he had killed, they were waiting for him. In the Chaitanya Charitamrita, we have story of Narad Muni meeting Mrigari, the hunter. And even this Mrigari was engaged in half killing animals. And even to him in the beginning, Narad Muni showed him a vision of how all these animals whom he had killed were going to take the revenge. Yes. So it's not that this is something that is to be found only in Buddhism. This is there in the Vedic scriptures also. In the purport to the Srimad Bhagavatam verse, Srila Prabhupada mentions some points which are very important for us. So he says, Narad Muni wanted to instruct the king about the real purpose of life and invoke a spirit of renunciation in his heart. So there are two things he wanted to instruct, and the purpose was to invoke renunciation. Knowledge and the spirit of renunciation, jnana and vairagya, are the ultimate goal of life. Without knowledge, one cannot become detached from material enjoyment. And without being detached from material enjoyment, one cannot make spiritual advancement. So this is something which is important for us to understand. Narad Muni wanted to convince the king that overindulgence in animal sacrifice is risky. Why is it risky? Because as soon as there is a small discrepancy in the execution of such a sacrifice, the slaughtered animal may not be promoted to a human form of life. Consequently, the person performing sacrifice will be responsible for the death of the animal just as much as a murderer is responsible for killing another man. So in today's times, we are living in insensitive times. When you kill another human being, that is counted as murder. However, when somebody kills another animal, that is not counted as murder. However, as per the original Vedic culture, even that is considered as a murder. So it's very risky. In the Gita 5.25, Lord Krishna is saying, Labhante brahma nirvanam rishaya kshina kalmasha chinna dvaidhaya tatmana sarva bhuta hiterata. Lord Krishna is talking about a devotee. And one of the qualities he mentions is sarva bhuta hite rata. That a devotee is not just engaged in hita, the benefit of just the human beings. Sarva bhuta hite rata. Sarva includes the trees, the birds, the animals and everyone. So Krishna is also mentioning this principle. Those who are beyond the dualities that arise from doubts, whose minds are engaged within, who are always busy working for the welfare of all living beings and who are free from all sins, achieve liberation in the Supreme. So in the Vedic culture also we find similar teachings, and here we see Buddhism is almost like a mirroring of the Bhagavad Gita, which was originally spoken 5,000 years back. At another place in the Gita, second chapter, Krishna speaks, Ya imam pushpitam vachan pravadanti avipaschita. Krishna says how people of less intelligence, avipaschita, are attracted to the flowery language of the Vedas. Sometimes the Vedas will speak, oh, you do this sacrifice, the Jyotishtoma sacrifice, and you can go to the heavenly planets where there is a lot of enjoyment possible. So people who are more on the bodily platform, they'll be attracted only to these sections of the Vedas. However, the Vedas have also other sections. But then we catch something which is very appealing to our minds, to appealing to our mindset, is it not? So this we have to understand, that the teachings that Lord Buddha taught are not just his original teachings, but they were as per the time, place and circumstance. In the 11th canto, where the different incarnations are mentioned, the sage Drumila, he says, Vadair vimohayati yagya krito atad arhan. Atad arhan means those who were not fit, those who were not qualified to perform sacrifices. These people were performing sacrifices, and these people were bewildered, vimohayati, by vada, by arguments. So that was Lord Buddha. These are some things that we should understand as a background. And in one prayer, in the Narayan Kavach Shield prayers in the 6th canto, I'll just read that one line. May Lord Buddha Dev protect me from activities opposed to Vedic principles and from laziness that causes one to madly forget the Vedic principles of knowledge and ritualistic action. So actually Lord Buddha is prayed to in the Narayan Kavach prayers to protect from activities opposed to Vedic principles. So it's interesting that Lord Buddha opposed the Vedas, denied the authority of the Vedas. And here we are praying to Lord Buddha Dev, to Lord Buddha, to prevent us from engaging in activities that are opposed to the Vedic principles. He himself did that. But then we should go back to the original example that we saw, that there is a purpose to an activity. And if the purpose is not being met, then sometimes the originator of that activity may change the nature of that activity to achieve the same purpose. Yes? In that purport, Prabhupada writes, one should therefore surrender to Lord Buddha so that he can help one avoid misusing the injunctions of the Vedas. Yeah. Saying, giving you a background of this, I'll just give a small background of what happened after Lord Buddha appeared. If he has denied the authority of the Vedas and if the purpose of the Vedas is to get attracted to Krishna, there had to be someone who could rectify the damage that Lord Buddha did. So Lord Krishna sent his very dear representative, Sripad Shankaracharya. Sripad Shankaracharya appeared in 708 AD, that is quite recently, and in a matter of 32 years, he just lived 32 years, he refuted the Buddhist philosophy with his fierce scholarly preaching. He traveled the whole of India. Now, where has Buddhism originated? In the land of India. However, today if you see, Buddhism is not to be found as the main religion in India. However, interestingly, just think about it. If you go north of India, there is China, Tibet, Nepal. Buddhism is very popular there. If you go south of India, Sri Lanka, very popular there. On the east side, Myanmar, Burma, yes, Vietnam and all those, Cambodia and all that. There Buddhism is very popular. But just see, it originated in India, but by the fierce preaching of Shankaracharya, he drove the Buddhists physically out of India. And of course, refuted the Buddhist philosophy also. But for doing this, he had to make it easy for people. In trying to refute the Vedas, Lord Buddha also had to give a purpose for life. So the original purpose of life, as per the people who were used to the corrupt practices, was pleasure. So Lord Buddha, in trying to refute the Vedas, he established the concept of nirvana. So nirvana, he said, as merging into the void, zero. So he said that after life there is a zero, and in that zero there is nothing to be experienced. There are some teachings that are primary to Buddhism. It's all intertwined. It's very difficult to, you know, take it in sections. Yes, but one teaching is that the causes of our problem, the cause of our suffering in this world, are our cravings, are our desires. So if your desires are like lamps, extinguish those desires. Extinguish those flames. Na rahega baas, na bajegi baasuri. So in doing this, he had to establish that actually all your problems are because of contaminated desires. So give up all desires. So after giving up all desires, where do I go? You go to that place which is devoid of all desires. There is nothing there. It's a zero. You just merge into zero. You become zero. So if Shankaracharya had to refute Buddhism, he could not immediately establish personalism from this concept of zero. He had to make the transition very easy and very doable for the people. So he established a concept based on the Vedas of the non-dual Brahman. So the Brahman is mentioned in the Vedic literature as a transcendental light, the divine effulgence coming from the body of the Lord. In the Gita, Krishna says, Brahmano hi pratishtham. So in trying to transmigrate people mentally from the philosophy of Buddhism to the philosophy of his philosophy, Shankaracharya's philosophy, which is called Advaita Vedanta, absolute non-dualism. Sorry, I'm getting a bit technical, but it's important to understand. He changed the Buddhist void into the Vedic Brahman. Now, on an external level, on a practical level, there is no difference. The Brahman also is undifferentiated. There are no non-qualitative light, all-pervading light. And the zero that Buddha talked is also that non-qualitative, undifferentiated and like that. However, because he quoted the Vedas to prove that the Brahman is the supreme, he again re-established the authority of the Vedas. So Buddhism was like a diversion. People got down from the train and they started drinking water, they started drinking this lime juice and all that. And then somebody had to bring them back at least in the direction of the train. So there was this Shankaracharya who again re-established the authority of the Vedas. Then he said, I think we have something to do with this train that is standing there. Don't you remember? Yes. But he didn't speak that, oh, the original purpose of the train was to get into the train and to have nice kirtan in the train and have nice prasad in the train and go to Vrindavan and have a nice time. That would be too difficult for them. They are too much caught up in that temporary pleasure. So Shankaracharya established the Brahman. This Brahman, if you see, one of our devotees, His Grace Ravindra Swarup Prabhu, he puts it in a very nice way. He says, this Brahman is more or less like an intellectual clone of the Buddhist void. It's like a clone, the same thing, but in a different way. So that was very attractive. At the time when Buddha came, there were 62 schools of philosophy in India. Even at the time of Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, we read in Mayapur, in Nadia district, how it was a place of very heated arguments. And who would be respected? The person who would argue. So Lord Buddha, he himself argued, but then in his own philosophy, there is not much place for argumentative debating. He would say, what is the point in putting forward arguments and talking about big, big concepts when our desires are so deeply rooted in pleasures of this world? We may speak big words, but what is there in the heart? The heart is craving for petty material pleasures. So he would deny any attempts to argue. One of the examples that he would give is, a person is standing and an arrow hits him. So when the arrow hits him, and let's say he wants to discuss, so who shot the arrow? From where did this arrow come? How come it hit at this angle? If it would have hit at this angle, then probably less blood would have come. So his primary understanding was, now that the arrow has hit you, first remove the arrow. First heal the wound. First dress the wound. That is much more important than talking about big, big subjects. So that was his emphasis. It was just plain useless to talk about metaphysical concepts when the desires were so much petty, were so much down to earth. Shankaracharya and Lord Buddha, we just saw how they did not give the highest truth, and they gave something which was seemingly against the highest truth. And here is Lord Buddha, who is very much against arguments. So how do we understand all this? So I'll give you one example. Right now they're building a very tall building, the tallest building till date in Dubai. So it's called Al Burj Khalifa. It's a very tall building. Now that building is like thousands of meters in the sky. But to build that building thousands of meters in the sky, first they dug into the ground. I found out some statistic of this particular building. So they dug 50 meters into the ground, and the foundation is made up of a huge triangular structure made up of steel beams. Each of these steel beams is 2 meters in diameter. And 50 meters of height of these steel beams, they're put into the ground, and then they have built a huge tower. Before that, One of the tallest buildings in the world was the twin Petronas towers in Malaysia. There's a company called Petronas. So they have these twin towers. They're also very tall. So I got good figures for that. The height of this Petronas towers is something like 1200 meters or something. For this, they went around 120 meters into the ground. Now this Al Burj Khalifa, if you see the structure, it's a very thin structure, but this twin Petronas towers is like bulky. There are two towers, so you have to have more deeper foundation. 120 meters into the ground, they built the foundation. It means when an architect is planning to build a huge tower, towering in the sky, it's called a skyscraper. It will scrape the sky. It will touch the sky. But the architect does not immediately try or venture into scraping the sky. Before scraping the sky, he has to first make a very solid foundation in the earth. Yes, it's very easy. Similarly, to establish the tower of pure theism, the Lord had to establish a very strong foundation of purity. And if the people were getting diverted into Karmakanda sections, they were getting diverted into getting engaged in those sections of the Vedas in which meat eating was allowed as a concession, if they were engaging too much into that, that would be not good for the establishment of pure theism. Yes. So Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu is trying to give us the highest Parama Purushartha, the Pancham Purushartha, much beyond Dharma, Artha, Kama, Moksha. But to receive that the highest Purushartha, we also have to be qualified in a certain way, is it not? If we are attached to small petty pleasures of this world, how will this highest gift ever be attractive to us? I have some objects in my hand. I have this kartal in my hand, and it's a small kartal, and there is a set of a big kartal here. Yes. So when I came for the class today, I have my own pair of kartals which I carry. So I carried them and then I used them. Now imagine a situation that I come to this place and I have to sing Radha Madhav and I don't have my kartals. What do I do? I have to search here and there and then I have to use these big kartals. So these big kartals will find their place into my hands only when my hands are empty. And probably these are much better kartals. However, I do not have the courage to try them out. I am very attached to my own kartals. Yes? I don't even know what these kartals sound like. So only when my hands are free, only when I don't carry my own kartals, will these kartals become attractive to me and then I'll play them. However, I have my own kartals. They're very attractive. They're very good. They produce very sweet sound. I don't even look at these kartals. So if somebody wants to give me something very high, one small condition for that is that I have to let go of my own understanding, at least for the time being, to understand. Long back in the beginning days of my Krishna consciousness, I had heard a small example and maybe it will come handy in this connection, that the way they catch monkeys to get them to amuse them in a street show or in a circus is that the monkeys are very attracted to this chana, nuts. Yeah. So what do? They have a glass jar. The people who want to catch monkeys, they have a glass jar and they fill it up with some chana. They fill it up with some nuts. The neck of that jar is only so much that the hand of a monkey will go inside. Yes? So this jar is kept in the open in the jungle and the monkey sees that jar and is attracted. So he says, oh, this looks like there's no one around. So he puts his hand inside. He catches hold of that chana. Now this is the catch. He is catching the chana, but there is a catch for him. When he's trying to remove his hand out, the neck of the jar was only that much wide as would allow his hand to go in empty-handed. But when his grip is tightened, then the circumference of his grip becomes bigger. It can no longer come out of the jar. What does he have to do? Simple thing, let go of the chana and take his hand out. Is it not? The glass jar, by the way, is very heavy. It's not a glass bottle. It's a glass jar. It's a heavy. He cannot in any circumstance carry the jar with him, with of course his chana inside it, to his tree and then, you know, break it and eat it. He can't do that. It's too heavy for him. He can't manage that. So he tries his best to drag the jar, not possible. He thinks, what to do now? He can't let go of that chana. That's too attractive. So after some time, very peacefully, the hunter will come. He does not have to run behind him. He does not have to carry a net. He takes something, probably a rope or something, puts it around his body, makes him a slave. So this is how a monkey is captured, that he is enjoying his freedom. However, that freedom is sacrificed for a few handful of these nuts. So that was the example of the tower of theism being built on a very strong foundation. That was something for us to understand. You have to work down if you want to think up. We should understand this. Krishna says in the Gita that many, many millennia ago, I had instructed this science to the sun god Vivaswan. But Mahat Kal, Sa Kale Neha Mahata, Yogo Nashta Parantapa, he describes time as a very powerful force in this world. Mahat Kal, he says. So this Mahat Kal, as per Lord Krishna, even created a distance, even created a gap in the teachings of the Bhagavad Gita, which are the personal teachings of Lord Krishna. Ya Swayam Padmanabhasya Mukha Padmad Vinisrita. What to speak of the teachings that are not pure in nature. Yes. So that's why if we want to establish pure theism, it's very important to create a strong foundation. And that strong foundation was established by the Buddha, that he first created mercy in the hearts of the people. In one of the shlokas, in the Dash Avatar Stotra by Jayadeva Goswami, he says, he is glorifying Lord Buddha, he's saying, Nindasi Yagya Vidhir Ahaha Shruti Jatam Sadaya Hridaya Darshit Pashughatam Keshavadhrita Buddha Sharira Jai Jagadish Hare Jai Jagadish Hare Jai Jagadish Hare. So the second line here is very important. Sadaya. Lord Buddha's heart, Sadaya Hridaya Darshita Pashughatam. Lord Buddha himself is very compassionate. His heart is overflowing with daya. His heart is overflowing with mercy. And that's why he instructed the path of mercy. How can a person who's engaging in acts of killing other living entities, who's not merciful to other living entities, he's attacking at the basic principle of daya, which is one of the four pillars of religion. How can this person ever advance towards the real path? So that was the purpose of Lord Buddha. One time, one scholar, a philosopher, his name was Vachagotta, he met Lord Buddha and he tried to understand, who is this Lord Buddha? So he asked, he was speaking about the existence or non-existence of the soul. And he asked Lord Buddha, what do you think about the soul? So Lord Buddha said, nothing. He kept silent. And then after the scholar went, he was looking for some answer. But no answer, so then how long could he wait? So he left. So one of the disciples asked Lord Buddha, why didn't you answer that question? Very important question. So Lord Buddha revealed his heart. He said, if I would have answered yes, then I would have agreed with the opinion of the Brahmanas. And at that time, so remember, the Brahmanas are corrupt. Yes? So he cannot agree with the Brahmanas. So he said, if I would have said yes, then I would have agreed with the Brahmanas. What if you would have said no? So he said, if I would have said no, I would have agreed with those people who say that there is nothing higher than the body. The body is all in all. So if the body is all in all, then bodily pleasures are all in all. So if bodily pleasures also include pleasure of the tongue, then that is also all in all. But that is against the Buddhist philosophy. So that is why the Lord never spoke about the existence of the soul in any of his teachings. That was some background for that. We should understand that a little bit of detachment is very necessary and is very important for gaining attachment to higher things. Srila Bhakti Siddhanta Saraswati, one of our most prominent acharyas gives the example of a marriage party. One time a marriage party, this is a scene in Bengal, so in that cultural setting we should understand this, that a marriage party, the bridegroom along with his friends and his people leaves from his village at night, and there's the marriage of this person in the morning the next day. Now in Bengal, all the villages are connected by the river, Ganges and other rivers. So mostly people will use the waterways to travel here and there. So they get into a boat and they're traveling to the other place. And in the morning, they expect to reach the place of his marriage. And at night, they take rest. When the darkness falls, they take rest. In the morning, when they get up, they see the horror of their horrors. They are still in the same place from where they started off. They did not move an inch. So what's the first reaction? The first reaction is, the person who was rowing the boat, he must have also slept. The first thing we want to blame is to blame somebody else. So they looked at the person who's rowing the boat, and he also looked at them, and to save himself, he pointed to all the sweat that he was sweating. He had rowed indeed very hard enough. So then they thought, if he has rowed the boat hard enough, but we are still in the same place, how do we understand this? Then some intelligent man pointed out to the anchor. The anchor of the boat had not been lifted. The anchor of the boat was still at the same place where they had started off from. So if the anchor was not lifted, how would you advance? It's very important to lift the anchor. What is the anchor? The anchor is attachment to the pleasures of this world. And rowing the boat is like following some spiritual process, and the destination is where we want to go. So this detachment is very important. In the Gita, Krishna says, Yehi samsparsha ja bhoga dukkha yonaya evate. He says that ordinary people think, oh, this is something very nice to eat, and when I put the substance which I like to eat on my tongue, then very nice sensations are created. There is a lot of pleasure there. But the samsparsha, this sparsha, out of that place itself, the seed for future misery is born. It's not that your happiness comes out from one thing and your distress comes out from another thing. This is a very revolutionary thought that Krishna is mentioning in the Gita. To understand what is pleasure, we'll have to understand this fundamental concept. We have to revise our understanding of what is pleasure. If today's pleasure is going to be the source of tomorrow's misery, why would I engage as an intelligent person in that pleasure today? Is it not? So that detachment is important. Think about it. I mean, if detachment is a very important thing, if a person who is ill, he is given some fried food, he is given something which is very difficult to digest, it's very attractive to the tongue. The tongue might say, oh, this is nice samosa, this is nice kachori. All in today's times, this is a nice pizza. Yeah, I think those examples we'll have to revise now. Yeah? So this is nice burger, this is nice pizza. However that, yes. Thank you. However, the cheese in these substances, pasta, pizza, burger and all that, very difficult to digest. Somebody is ill, it's not good for him to eat these substances. So some detachment from these substances, at least when you are ill, is very good. It will help prolong the life of this person. So this detachment is good. However, emphasizing that detachment over anything else, that would not be the right thing. So a person who's ill, he might be told by the doctor, so from today onwards, eat simple khichdi. No spices in that khichdi, no sabji in that khichdi, just plain khichdi. What to speak of pasta, pizza and all that, no, nothing of like that. However, when he becomes well, when he becomes nice, his health is good. And if this doctor again tells him, no, you are well, but I think you should still eat that simple khichdi without sabji, without spices, that would be too much, is it not? So once somebody becomes well, then he should shift to a good diet. He should shift to a normal, attractive diet. What is today's primary religion? Some people say in the US there is a new religion called Wicca. So this is the fastest growing religion today. That's what they say. As far as the numerical figures go, there is a certain religion that has, on paper at least, the maximum number of adherents. Where they actually practice that or not, that's a different issue. However, when they write their religion, they write that. Yes? Let's just, you know, speak on this a little bit. Am I wrong if I say that today's religion is not Hinduism, today's primary religion, most prominent religion is not Christianity, is not Islam, is not Sikhism, is not Jainism, is not Buddhism, is not anything else, it is materialism? Think about it. The Hindus, the Muslims, the Christians, the Buddhists, the Jains, and whatever else, they watch the same television show and enjoy the same television show very happily. The food habits of all these people today are the same. Sometime back, the Hindus would eat something, somebody else would eat something, the Punjabis would eat chole, bhature, and like that. The South Indians would eat idli, dosa, and like that. Yes. Now, I would say for the generation, which is like in the 30s, 40s now, if you approach a South Indian middle-aged person, you would say, yeah, idli is very nice, dosa is very nice, and like that. If you ask his kid, what will he say? You said that, yeah? Sometime back you said that. If you offer him idli and all, he'll say, isme kuch maja nahi hai. Pizza, pasta. You go to some North Indian's home, and for Sunday probably, you know, the husband and wife, the mother and the father, they are having the traditional Punjabi food. But if you ask their kid, what do you like? Hey, isme kuch maja nahi hai. What would he say? Same thing, is it not? There used to be regional movies when I was a small kid. At my home, I remember still those days, there was no cable television. On Sunday, in the afternoon, they would, on DD1, they would show a regional movie. So one day they would show a Telugu movie, one day they would show some other movies like that. Good movies, with some social message. Now if you see, everyone in Bombay watches the same movie, is it not? The same values. So the point that I'm trying to say is, what we identify as religion today is only for namesake. The effect of religion is only in terms of the photographs that you will worship for 2 minutes in your home in the morning. I'm not speaking this in a humorous way, although, I mean, you're free to do that. Honestly. But after that 2 minutes rendezvous, interaction with your photographs, with your DTs, what do you do the rest of the day? The same jokes everyone cracks. The same thoughts everyone has. How to make more money? How should I go on an H-1V to the US of A? Is it that only the Hindus want to do this? Is it that only the Muslims want to do this? Is it that only the Sikhs want to do that? So that's why I mentioned in the beginning that, you can correct me if I'm wrong, but today's religion is not Hinduism or anything else. Today's religion is materialism. Never before has one single religion been so popular. Never before. The reach of materialism is really amazing. How everyone, irrespective of sex, caste, creed, nationality, has been corrupted by this disease of materialism. Now, sometimes, in the course of enjoying nicely, we might come across somebody who has developed a little bit of detachment, because we were talking of detachment earlier. So, somebody, you know, overindulgence in something sometimes causes detachment. We have seen sometimes when we are distributing sweets, somebody says, no, no sweets today. And then you wonder, how come? So he says, no, actually, no, yesterday was a festival. So I had a lot of charanamrit, I had a lot of sweets. So then today, no sweets. However, in the normal course of life, you know, people would like sweets, is it not? So a person who is too much indulging in sense pleasures, sometimes there is a chance that he might refrain from it. So in this hardcore materialism that we are practicing nowadays, sometimes you could come across somebody in your office who has never come for a Bhagavatam class, who's never attended a Sunday feast, who's never chanted Hare Krishna, but you feel, Hare, you know, Prabhuji, aap ye detachment ka bol rahe hain. So in my office, there is this person who has no connection with any religion, but he's very detached. Sometimes I offer him something and he says, no, nothing like that. So we should not get fooled, yes? There are three vairagya, vairagya is detachment. There are three vairagyas that are mentioned. And this is a cultural thing, this is not in the Bhagavatam, but good for us. So one vairagya is called abhava vairagya. Abhava vairagya means there is dearth of something and then it induces vairagya in you. Do you remember this story of a fox being attracted to grapes, but those grapes were very tall and he tried a lot to get those grapes. However, at one point of time, he just thought, you know, it's too much. All that jumping and all is causing me a lot of fatigue trying to reach those grapes. Better I just renounce the desire to enjoy those grapes. But as he renounced the desire for those grapes, what did he do? He passed a comment. What was the comment? Anyways, the grapes are sour. Is it not? Not fit for me. Yeah. So that is called abhava vairagya. Sometimes detachment may manifest in somebody out of non-availability of resources. So somebody is trying to go to the US a lot, he applies for a visa, every time gets rejected. So after 5 years you ask him, hey, you know, you wanted to go to the US and how come, you know, right now you speak a lot about being in India, hum Bharatiya hain, like that. India is the country to be. So he says, yeah, I have realized that. Anyway, America is not a good country. So you should understand, yeah, it could be abhava vairagya. The second vairagya is smashana vairagya. What is this smashana vairagya? Smashana is a place of intense detachment. In fact, sometimes people are advised, saintly people who are wanting to advance on the spiritual path, they're advised to develop detachment by going and spending some time in the smashan, in the funeral place, and seeing all those bodies being burnt. It induces a lot of vairagya, yes? His Holiness Radhanath Maharaj would go in Varanasi at the Manikarnika Ghat and he would sit there for a long, long time, just trying to understand the impermanence of life. However, he did something after that also. He just didn't stay satisfied there, is it not? Some people, they can go to this smashan. Maybe some of the relatives have left and like that. And they see how the body is brought in and is laid on a pile of wood and then is lit. And in a matter of minutes, if you have ever been to a funeral, a ceremony, in a matter of minutes, the whole body is burnt. The skin melts, the hair smelts. So seeing all that, sometimes a person can develop some detachment and say, I'm enjoying so much. I'm favoring this body. I'm splurging so much money on this body. However, if this is the end of the body, all this is going to be reduced to ashes after some years. Why am I being so much attached to this body? This vairagya can come. But however, this vairagya is called smashana vairagya. You can understand from the name. This vairagya lasts only in the boundary wall of the smashan. As soon as this person comes, he takes a bath. Yes? And along with the bath, along with the water, all the impurities go away. That vairagya also goes away. No, he calls for a nice lifestyle now. The next day again, everything resumes. So the first vairagya is born out of non-availability. This vairagya is born out of some contemplation on an intellectual level, not on a practical level, but some intellectual contemplation happens. The third detachment is called prasava or prasuti vairagya. Now, prasava or prasuti is the act of giving birth to a child. It is explained it's very painful for a mother to give birth to a child. So it is mentioned in the scriptures that sometimes a mother, when she gives birth to a child, experiencing all that pain, she says, now no more. However, for some reasons, we see in this world that families prefer to have more than one child. So this vairagya is also very short lasting, and this is called prasava prasuti vairagya. So in this culture that is pervaded by materialism, in today's culture where the single most important religion, the single most religion which has the most number of members is materialism, Buddhism has its appeal. Buddhism definitely has some attraction. At one point of time, there was this king Ashoka, who was belonging to the Vedic fold, and he fought a war. In that war, he came across a lot of people getting killed. We have some semblance with Yudhishthir Maharaj. After the Mahabharata war, he also thought, what is the need for engaging in a war if so many people and so many living entities are killed? So King Ashoka, he was one of those most prominent people who, as a king, converted to Buddhism, seeing the after effects of a war, after effects of... So after he became a Buddhist, since he had power, he was a king, he even sponsored missionaries to go in all directions to Sri Lanka and to Tibet and all that and preach Buddhism. In fact, some years back, I remember when the Taliban took over Afghanistan, I remember there was a news in the newspapers how near Kandahar, they came across huge statues of Lord Buddha. Very huge statues of Lord Buddha. And when the Taliban first came there, one of the first things that they did was shoot down these huge stone statues of Lord Buddha. So Buddhism was there. Yes. What is the appeal of Buddhism? I've noted some points. One is that its emphasis on a very simple, down-to-earth lifestyle. What are the principles to be followed? Simplicity, humility, non-violence, talking pleasantly with the people of this world. So people who are too much affected by materialism and they are too much affected by the competition, the rat race of this world, sometimes these talks of being silent, being nice, they're very attractive. So people want to get away from the craziness of this world, and Buddhism is very attractive. It speaks more about the mind. It speaks more about the nature of the mind, how to control the mind. So it's very attractive. Not much talk about the theological implications. Not much talk about the spiritual world. Yes? So you get some kind of an immediate relief from your problems in the silence. Sometimes if the noise level becomes too much, sometimes even in a kirtan, then devotees feel, you know, sometime I want some place where there's some silence. Obviously, they have not relished the sweetness of Harinam, but in today's times, who has? Very few people have, so Buddhism has its appeal. One very important factor of the appeal of Buddhism is that there is the lack of theism in Buddhism. There is no God overhead. There is no person to whom you have to answer after this life. Yes, so that people who have been exposed to the concept of God as somebody to whom you are responsible, who's going to ask you questions, why did you do that? Now you're going to get a punishment for that. Why did you hurt that person? Now I'm going to punish you for that. So people especially who have been born and raised in a culture where fear was the most prominent emotion given to them vis-a-vis their relationship with God, to these people, Buddhism is a big relief. I'm not answerable to anybody. Then what do I have to do? Just sit, meditate. Meditate on the sound of one hand clapping. Sometimes they are given this instruction. Meditate on the sound of one hand clapping. There's no sound like that. It means stay where you are. Don't ask questions. Just sit still. Yes? So these are some of the appeals of Buddhism. So who is this Buddha? Now we'll come to the second part of the... This was the background. So who is this Buddha? So the term Buddha simply means the enlightened one. Or sometimes it means the awake. The person who is awake. The most famous Buddha in today's times is... Technically is called the Shakyamuni Buddha. There was a dynasty of the Shakyas. They are in the solar dynasty, the Surya Vamsha. And they were at one point of time ruling Nepal. So the sadhu Shakyamuni Buddha is the sage who was born in the family of the Shakyas. He is called Siddhartha. So he is the most famous Buddha. One time, a very pious man called Dona, he approached the Buddha, and seeing his effulgence, seeing his bright face, he asked him, "Are you a divine spirit?" Lord Buddha said, "No." He would speak like this in a very calm way. "Are you a divine angel?" The Buddha answered, "No." "No? Then you must be God then, if you are none of this?" Then Lord Buddha said, "No." Just look at this, that he is not giving any extra information other than just answering the basic question that the person is asking. In the previous example also we saw that. So this person, he just became frustrated, raised his hands and said, "If you are not an angel, if you are not a divine spirit, if you are not God, then who are you? Kaun hai aap?" Sometimes it happens like that. So the Lord Buddha simply looked at him eye to eye and said, "I am awake." He refused to give any further information about himself. He just said, "I am awake." Yes. So this Buddha, who is very famous, he was named Siddhartha. He was born in the Shakya dynasty. His father was Shuddhodhan. This king, since his son was very dear to him, he made all luxuries available to his son. Actually, in the early part of his life, there was one sage called Asita. This is not the same Asita as is mentioned in the Gita. This sage had mentioned that if ever your son comes across some miseries in life, there is a chance that he might take to some path of renunciation. And which father likes his son to be on the path of renunciation? So King Shuddhodan took upon himself this mighty task to drown his son in luxuries. He had 3 palaces made for him for every season, monsoon, winter and summer, different palaces. Yes. So everything was available to him. There were plenty of servants. All necessities were given to him. Every effort was made to shield Siddharth from any misery. The servants that were there in his service were always young. They were always free from any diseases. They were themselves well taken care of so that they would be happy. They would be ever smiling in the presence of their prince. In this way, many years passed. But just some days after his 29th birthday, one time he was moving around and something went wrong. The guards around him could not protect him from coming across misery. He came across an old decrepit man, frail, toothless, bent. And Lord Buddha Siddharth in those days, he could not understand. He had never seen an old man. Everyone around him was always young, happy, good-looking, bright-faced. So he asked one of the servants, "What is this? Who is this? Is he from some another species or what?" He said, "No, this is something called as old age. And every one of us has to pass through this stage." This first encounter with old age struck the heart of Buddha like an arrow. All his composure, all his tendencies for enjoyment evaporated. That day when Siddharth returned to the palace, he was a changed man. King Shuddhodan detected that. He remembered the prophecy. He punished those who were there with Siddharth. How could you let this happen? Don't you understand the seriousness of the situation? Here is a prince. He might take to a path of renunciation. This is not good. So he punished and immediately he arranged for a grand ceremony of enjoyment. Again he drowned or tried to drown Siddharth in an ocean of enjoyment. And it seemed that yes, he has again become jovial, he has again become happy. No. But the heart was forever affected by that sight. After some days, similarly, because Siddharth was already affected, he searched for some another way to get exposed to the world outside his palace. And this time he came across a dead man. They were carrying a corpse. So what is this? So this is death. That is after illness. That is after old age. In this way, Siddharth was exposed to the harsh realities of life in a very sudden way. It was not very gradual. Suddenly he was face to face with the ugly reality of life. An intense feeling of renunciation manifested in his heart. However, just by renunciation, he could not go further. One day as he was traveling, he also came across a saffron-robed sadhu, a sannyasi. And in his talks with this sannyasi, there are two different versions. One version says he talked with this sannyasi, and another version, he just saw that sannyasi, he looked different. People in the normal world, they have long hair, dressed nicely. They have colors, different colored clothes, yes. The sannyasi had saffron up and saffron down, shaven head. So he looked different. So just like the old man looked different, the dead corpse looked different from his previous experience. Siddharth asked one of his servants, who is this? He also looks different. So he is a renunciant. So what is a renunciant? So he said, this person is trying to understand the source of miseries in this life. Now, if we remember, Siddharth had also seen an old man, a corpse and like that. So he asked this servant, will he not undergo old age? Will he not undergo death if he is engaged in something which the normal world is not engaged in? So the answer was very prompt. He said, no, he'll also become old. He'll also become exposed to diseases. He'll also die. But he is trying to do it for the last time. He's trying to solve the problem of birth, old age, disease and death in such a way that this is his last time he will suffer. So he'll be exposed to this suffering, but this is the last time he's going to undergo. This feeling, this information caught the heart of Siddharth. Now his renunciation was complete. He said, yes, this is something that I have to do. At this time, when these feelings were manifesting in his heart, his wife Yashodhara gave birth to a young son. So very intense moments are happening in his life. On one side, he's being exposed to the harsh realities of life. He's getting a very different perspective on life. And at the other time, he's also experiencing a pleasure that is so dear to everyone. When a son is born in a family, how happy do the parents become? So Siddharth is being pulled on both sides by these kind of feelings. However, at one point of time, he decided that not only for myself, but for the world at large, I'm going to renounce my family and take to the path of renunciation, understand how to solve these problems of birth, old age, disease and death, and help others also overcome these problems. Now you and me, have we seen a newborn baby? Yes. Have we seen an old man? Yes. Have we seen a diseased person? Yes. Have we visited hospitals that are full of diseased people? Yes. Have we seen death? Yes. How many times when we saw these four occurrences, did a spirit of renunciation arouse in our heart? This is the difference. We have seen old people, but sometimes we thought, oh, he's just old. Or if some of you who are compassionate might have developed a desire to help that person. But his old age never induced us to inquire into what is this old age? Is there any way to circumvent this old age? Some people in this world are trying to solve the problem of old age in a way, you know, they just take water, they just drink water, they just eat fruits. They want to prolong old age. Can they solve old age? No. They can prolong. They can show to the external world their tight skin. They can perform plastic surgery and just show to the world externally that they are young. Are their organs inside also young? No. They are undergoing deterioration. In fact, one very famous old man who looked young passed away recently, some months back. He looked very young. Yes. So he might claim that he never passed through the stage of old age, but death overcame him very soon. Is it not? So that is the difference between us and Siddharth. That when he came across the same common sights, these are common sights. However, these common sights induced uncommon feelings in his heart. Yes. So he gave up his attachments and he traveled all the way to Gaya, it is mentioned, which is in Bihar. And he sat under a Bodhi tree there. And under that tree he sat for around 6 months and he developed enlightenment in that place. And it is mentioned that for 7 days when he got enlightenment, he was just enjoying the bliss of this knowledge. He suddenly, you know, it was revealed to him how to overcome this cycle of birth, old age, disease and death, and he just enjoyed it. And then of course he spread it to others. We'll go to the third part. In the Bhagavatam, in the 10th canto, in the beginning of the 10th canto, it is mentioned. One of the qualities of a person who wants to advance on the spiritual path, very interestingly, specifically it is mentioned. Puman virajyada vina pashugnat. So very clearly, Shukdev Goswami, while instructing Parikshit Maharaj at the beginning of the 10th canto, when he's going to speak the glories of the Supreme Lord Shri Krishna, the Sambonam, he puts forward one very important qualification for somebody who wants to understand Krishna consciousness. He says, everyone else can advance on this path, everyone else can understand Krishna consciousness, except a person who engages in animal slaughter. Vina Pashugnat. Yes? So this animal killing was severely condemned by Lord Buddha. He taught us moral principles. Moral principles immediately transport you to the sattva guna. Now, the Vaishnavas are interested in getting to the Shuddha Sattva. However, we should understand that Shuddha Sattva is attainable through sattva. We many times give this example that I want to fly to another place. Let's say I want to fly to Delhi. It's not possible for me to fly to Delhi from my place here in this temple. First, I have to go to the airport. That airport is a very suitable place where planes or helicopters can land and take off. So I have to make the journey from my home, from my workplace to the airport, get into a suitable vehicle and then fly off. Yes. So if the destination where I can fly off is the spiritual world, is Shuddha Sattva, seeing Krishna face to face, then reaching the airport and the environment of the airport is like the Sattva Gun. It is there in this world. However, it provides a very unique platform for taking off to the spiritual world. Just to give something which is relevant to today's times, cricket is very popular in India. Yes, so we sometimes see people practicing cricket, playing cricket in the streets. Yes, but it has its own dangers. Sometimes you could break a window pane of some neighbor and he might stop you from playing there. It's not safe to play there. You might break some windshield of some car or something. It might become difficult for you. The best place for playing cricket is a pitch, is a proper cricket ground on which there is a proper pitch. There is a proper environment to play there. That's a proper place to play there. Yes. So Lord Buddha gave some kind of moral principles in which we reach the sattva gun, and then based on that sattva gun, we can go further to the Shuddha Sattva. In one purport in Madhya Leela 25.42, Srila Prabhupada says, unless one is free from the sin of animal killing, he cannot understand religion or God. Although Lord Buddha was an incarnation of Krishna, he did not speak about God, for the people were unable to understand. He simply wanted to stop animal killing. Sripad Shankaracharya, who came later after that, wanted to establish the predominance of one's spiritual identity. Remember, Lord Buddha did not speak about the spirit soul. Therefore, he wanted to convert the atheists through an imaginary interpretation of the Vedic literatures. This is a very important line now. These are the secrets of the Acharyas. Sometimes they conceal the real purport of the Vedas and explain the Vedas in a different way. Very nice line. These are the secrets of the Acharyas. Lord Shri Krishna, even in the Gita, mentions ahimsa, non-violence, as one of the qualities of a devotee. Daivi sampat, he says, it's one of the qualities of a devotee. Yeah. So there are a lot of points. In the early days, when the Westerners met Srila Prabhupada, Hayagriv Prabhu, one of his first acquaintances in the West, he mentions that when they asked Prabhupada what is his name, they first did not catch it properly. So for some time they were exposed to Buddha in the West. So they thought Prabhupada's name is Prabuddha, like that. I agree, Prabhu mentions that. You know, that was something that was familiar to them. They thought he is Prabuddha. Satyaraj Prabhu, he is another disciple of Srila Prabhupada. He mentions one incident. One time, His Holiness Tamal Krishna Maharaj, he was introducing some new devotees to Prabhupada. And Satyaraj Prabhu was standing in queue, waiting to be introduced to Prabhupada. So before him, there was one devotee. And Tamal Krishna Maharaj introduced this devotee to Prabhupada and said, Prabhupada, this devotee was a Buddhist before. So he was practicing Buddhism. So Srila Prabhupada's eyes widened. He said, oh, you were a Buddhist? So why have you become Krishna conscious now? Why have you taken to Krishna consciousness now? So I'll read the exact words. It's very nice. Why have you left Buddhism for this Krishna consciousness? So the boy, young boy, he thought deeply for a moment and then he said, well, Prabhupada, in Buddhism I learned what reality is not. I did not learn what reality actually is. So many times in the refutations, this boy did not get good information about what reality actually is. I was told, he's replying to Srila Prabhupada, I was told, it is not this, it is not this, but there seemed to be little or no positive spiritual information. Srila Prabhupada's eyes opened wide and then he was visibly pleased and he said, yes. He said, Buddhism is zero, Shunyavad. That is the primary tenets of Buddhism, that actually reality, the absolute truth, is zero. But it does not speak about any further information. If somebody asks you, what is a zebra? So one way of answering that question is, it's an animal which looks like a horse. The only difference is that it has black and white stripes all over. This is a very good definition, understanding of a zebra. Another way is, you ask somebody, what's a zebra? And he says, it's not a short animal. So, okay, it's not a short animal. Is it like a giraffe? No, it's not like a giraffe. It's not like a tall animal. Okay, it's not a short animal, it's not a tall animal. Does it have a lot of hair around the neck, a mane, like a lion? No, it does not have hair like a lion. Okay, it does not have hair like a lion. Does it have a long neck? No, actually, it does not have a long neck. So, probably you being a gentleman, you know, will pursue this conversation for some time, but then at one point, okay, if it is not a tall animal, if it's not a short animal, if it's not an animal with a lot of hair around the neck, and if it's not an animal this way, that way, can you please tell me what it is? It's frustrating, is it not, to just get answers, not like this, not like this, not like this. Okay, then how to? Tell me. I'm interested. So Buddhism, for the most part, speaks about the absolute truth in this way. Is it matter? No, it's not matter. Then is it a person? No, it's not a person. Then what it is? It's a zero. Yes? So then that's where it does not score very high. There are some incidents from the life of Lord Buddha, which we'll try to see. One time one lady approached Lord Buddha. She was in very great pain. And she said that her only son, who was a young boy, had died recently. So she was in great pain. So she approached to Buddha and said, my only child is dead. Take pity on me and bring my son to life. You're so powerful. You can do that. So Lord Buddha said, yes, why not? I'll do that. Can you get me a handful of mustard seeds, please? Yeah, of course. But there's a small condition. The condition is that you should bring those mustard seeds from the home of a person in whose family no one has ever died. Now, sometimes when you're too happy or when sometimes you're in too much sorrow, your intelligence does not work properly. So this lady was in too much grief and she actually started approaching homes. She begged for a handful of mustard seeds. And as soon as the person would be ready to give, she would remember that condition and she would put forward that condition. One thing is that nobody in your home must have died. People would obviously step back. No, that's not possible. So in a matter of some time, this lady realized there is no place, there is no home where nobody has ever died. It means this is common for all. Yes. So when she came back empty-handed to Lord Buddha told her, just have to accept some sufferings. People are, this world is temporary and people in this world are temporary. One time one dacoit approached Lord Buddha, and Lord Buddha was requested by his people to reform this dacoit. So when this dacoit came, he had some respect for sadhus. He was sitting very quietly waiting for some instruction from Lord Buddha. Lord Buddha said, can you do me one favor? Yes. Can you pluck one leaf from this tree and bring it to me? So for a dacoit who's killing people, it's not a big thing. So he got up, plucked the leaf, brought it very happily to Lord Buddha. Then Lord Buddha said, can you do me one more favor? Yes. Can you put this leaf back on the tree? This dacoit was overwhelmed. He understood, to take life is very easy. To give life is very difficult. Yes. So the lesson was learnt that the dacoit should no longer kill people. Just like he cannot put the leaf back. Yes. I'll read one small quote from Srila Prabhupada in his book, A Second Chance. It's good to understand what the acharyas have to say. Buddhist philosophy is incomplete. But that does not mean Lord Buddha did not know the complete truth. A teacher may have received his master's degree, yet he still teaches the ABCs to his students. It is not that his knowledge is limited to the ABCs. Similarly, any especially empowered incarnation, Shaktyavesh Avatar, will preach God consciousness according to time, place and circumstance. The teacher holds his master's degree, but the students may not be qualified to receive the high instructions that the teacher is competent to teach. So that's why we respect Lord Buddha as one of the incarnations, but we do not accept his philosophy of Shunyavad. Interestingly, just because you and me are trying to understand it from a Gaudiya Vaishnava perspective, does not Rupa Goswami mention as one of the foundations of Gaudiya Vaishnava philosophy, Anya Abhilashita Shunyam? He says that, is it not? Anya Abhilashita Shunyam, Jnana Karmadi Anavritam, Anukulyana Krishna Anushilanam, Bhakti Ruttama. So for Uttama Bhakti to happen, for Krishna Anushilanam to happen, the first thing is Anya Abhilashita Shunyam. So he's saying, to fill your heart with spiritual desires, first you will have to empty your heart of all material desires. So in one sense, Buddha's teachings in the initial period, they match with even Srila Rupa Goswami's teachings. He's also talking, if desires are like lamps, extinguish those desires. However, there's much more for us to learn. At one point of time, one important member of the Indian independence movement, Shamanand Chakravarti, he met Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati. And he approached, he saw Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Prabhupada as one important member of the Hindu saints. So he asked him a lot of questions about Hindu spirituality. And then he also asked, what do you think about the Bauddhas? Bauddhas means the followers of Lord Buddha. So Srila Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati answered directly and forcefully, as he would always do. He said, Bauddha is another name for Vaishnava. He augmented his statement, of course, with a little bit of admonition. He chastised a little bit. He said, however, modern day Bauddhas are wanting in true knowledge of the soul, and for the most part, they have deviated from the Buddha's original teachings. So the modern day Buddhist may not exactly follow the teachings. We discussed in the first part of the class today, what was the reason why Lord Buddha came? To stop the animal sacrifices. Sadaya Ridaya Darshita Pashu Ghatam. Non-violence was the first thing that inspired the Lord to come in his form as Lord Buddha. However, many modern day Buddhists engage in meat eating. So the reason for which Lord Buddha appeared, and there are some people who are claiming to be his followers, but they take meat. The justification is that they themselves have not killed the animal. they themselves have not witnessed the killing of the animal. There are some technical things that Lord Buddha mentioned, that you should not see the killing of the animal, you should not even cut the animal yourself. Well, if somebody else has killed at some other part, is it okay? Yes, so many times people everywhere fall prey to following the letter of the law and not the spirit of the law. So they go for this technical small loops. Say, so, yeah, I didn't see it getting killed. I am not the person who killed. I did not transport. However, Manusmriti mentions six people are, they get caught up, they are implicated in an act of killing. The person who eats, the person who cooks, the person who transports, and three others. So even these people, they will be implicated. In the Bhagavatam, in the seventh canto, Narad Muni is mentioning about five kinds of irreligion. He talks about chala dharma, and one of the ways in which religion can be distorted is upadharma. So what is this upadharma? Upadharma means, what is the highest dharma? Highest dharma is to love God, to serve God. But there are some sub-religious principles. Sub-religious principles, as in, these principles when followed, qualify you to go higher. One example is, you know, you want to work somewhere. So to work somewhere, in today's times, graduation is very important. And as time is progressing, probably post-graduation is also important. Somebody wants to enter into graduation, HSC is a pre-qualification for that. For somebody who wants to go for HSC, SSC is a pre-qualification for that. So is SSC not important? Very important. Somebody who does not do SSC, he'll not stand a good chance to earn his living in this world. But SSC is not the end. After SSC, you should go for higher education and so on. If somebody says SSC is very important, so you accept it and you stop there, that's not very good. So upadharma, one of the examples of upadharma is Buddhism, in which one of the sub-religious principles, which is favorable for the highest religion, but not the end, as in non-violence, is emphasized over surrender to God. Now interestingly, Lord Buddha himself is God, so people who surrender to him have surrendered to God, but in their conception of the religion, there is no God, because everything is zero. So, one way to understand Lord Buddha is that Lord Buddha is the mercy incarnation of God. He's so merciful that he came to save people from the vices of killing animals, and he also came to save the animals from being brutally murdered. Yes, so he is mercy incarnate. One another way of seeing Lord Buddha is that he also represents the transcendental trickery of the Lord, the transcendental cleverness of the Lord. The Lord is so intelligent that he can do and he can manipulate to emphasize that upadharma sometimes has to be given to people who do not understand the highest religion. Yeah. In the Gita, in the second chapter, Lord Krishna is mentioning, and Prabhupada writes in the purport, religion without philosophy is sentiment or sometimes fanaticism. And philosophy without religion is mental speculation. What is religion? Religion is following God, following the orders of God. So in Buddhist philosophy, there is no mention of God, but Buddha himself is God. That's how he tricks people into following religion. The Gaudiya Vaishnava understanding on this is that violence is unavoidable. Even as I'm breathing, even as I'm speaking, some microorganisms on my tongue, some microorganisms in my nose are being killed. So non-violence as an absolute principle cannot be followed. It's good, it's a good platform to advance. However, there is some violence that is inherently present in this world. When a predator, when a dangerous animal enters a cow shed, and if that animal is about to devour all the cattle in the cow shed, what should you do? As a principle of non-violence, should you stop anybody who is trying to prevent that man-eater animal? A lion enters a cow shed and he'll eat all the cows. So if somebody who's practicing non-violence, a question comes in his mind, should he not be violent on the animal who has just recently entered and who will cause violence to so many other animals? Or should he allow violence on the cows to be had by practicing non-violence, by not hurting this lion or this violent animal who has entered? Yes, this is the question. Or in a modern setting, let's say you are traveling on the street and a gunda, a ruffian, attacks your friend. Obviously, he's very violent. But if a person is emphasizing the principle of non-violence over and above everything, the highest is ahimsa paramo dharmo. The Buddhist teaching is ahimsa paramo dharmo. So if your friend is getting brutally attacked and kicked and punched, what will you do? You'll practice non-violence and let him be kicked and let all those things happen to him. Or you'll practice violence only on a person who himself is violent. And by practicing violence on a person who himself is violent, that's a way of practicing non-violence. How? That you'll teach a good lesson to this person who is becoming violent unnecessarily on people, and thereby you save so many others from being the recipient of this person's violence. So there is one way in which non-violence can be practiced, but there's also a higher way in which non-violence can be practiced. Yes? So we should understand that. There are the bharavahis and there are the saragrahis. The bharavahis are attached to only the statements in the scriptures. They'll take the statement literally and they'll carry on with their life. But the saragrahis, they take the essence, they understand this principle is mentioned in the scriptures for a particular purpose. Yes? Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has given us the Yuga Dharma. We are just 5 minutes away. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has given us the Yuga Dharma. As the followers of Lord Chaitanya, we should understand this. Harinam Sankirtan. In the Shikshashtakam prayers, the first verse gives us the benefits of Harinam Sankirtan. So what is the first verse of Harinam Shikshashtakam? Cheto Darpana Marjanam. The first effect is cleansing of the heart. What is the second effect? Bhava Mahadavagni Nirvapanam. Bhava Mahadavagni Nirvapanam means the suffering of the conditioned living entities who are getting tortured, who are getting burnt by the blazing fire of this material world, which is like a forest fire. Bhava Mahadavagni Nirvapanam. One gets relief from the burns, from the heat of this blazing forest fire of material existence. Now Buddhism is giving us that. Buddhism is giving us cessation from suffering. Yes, extinguish those desires. The seven effects of Harinam, the second effect of the seven effects is Bhava Mahadavagni Nirvapanam. That Bhava Mahadavagni Nirvapanam will come to us by properly practicing the Buddhism. Yes. However, Mahaprabhu is giving it to us right in the second effect of properly, offenselessly chanting and taking shelter of this Hare Krishna mantra. Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare, Hare Ram, Ram Ram, Hare Hare. And after this Bhava Mahadavagni Nirvapanam, what awaits us? Zero? No. Shunyatya? No. Void? No. Brahman? No. What awaits us? Shreyah Kairava Chandrika Vitaranam. The cooling, soothing moon rays of the spiritual world, they await us. Yes? So, I'll just summarize this. Lord Buddha gave us zero, shunyata. After that, Sripad Shankaracharya, he established Advaitavad. Advaita is one, everything is one. The soul, the supreme soul, everything is one. There is one Brahman. And the Acharyas after that, especially Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, said, why zero? No. Why one? No. Infinity. They gave us the conception of the Supreme Absolute Truth as Lord Sri Krishna, Parasya Shaktir Vividhaiva Shruyate. This person has unlimited beauty, has unlimited opulences. He has unlimited energies serving him. There are innumerable spiritual planets, Vaikuntha planets in the spiritual world. There are innumerable living entities who are Nitya Siddhas, who are very amazingly, very lovingly serving Him, worshipping Him. So what we are getting now is not zero, is not even one. It is infinity. So if we take proper shelter of the process that is given to us by our acharyas, if we chant this Hare Krishna mantra properly, as mentioned in the previous section of the discussion today, we quoted a few references from the Gita and the Bhagavatam, Narad Muni's instructions to King Prachina Barheshat, Narad Muni's instructions to Mrigari, Lord Krishna saying, Ya imam pushpitam vacham, we should not be attached to the flowery words of the Vedas. We saw this teachings of Buddhism of non-violence are included. Anya abhilashita shunyam, the shunyata in Buddhism is also included. But we are getting much more. We are getting much more beyond zero. We are getting much more beyond one. We are getting access to the supreme, absolute, infinite person, Shri Krishna. So I'll stop here. And we'll have kirtan now. I request everyone to participate in this kirtan. Yeah.